October 2003 was a time of unrestrained joy in the UCSD economics department. You know, economists are, do the dismal science. For weeks on end, you saw economists with smiles on their faces. It was embarrassing. That's when we learned that our colleagues Rob Engel and Clive Granger had won the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. Colleagues and students were overjoyed at the recognition that Clive and Rob had received. In addition, Clive has been designated a Knight Bachelor by Queen Elizabeth, Queen of England, Scotland, and Wales. So Clive is not only now Nobel laureate, he's Nobel laureate Sir Clive Granger. The titles get longer with time. Clive and Rob joined the UCSD faculty in the mid-1970s. For a quarter of a century, it was Engel and Granger who gave UCSD economics, UCSD econometrics, its distinctive character. Students and colleagues from all over the world came to study, came to do research with Clive and Rob, because UCSD was the premier institution throughout the world for time series econometrics. That's Clive and Rob's specialty. They'll be discussing it today. A three-line summary would be time series econometrics is the statistical analysis of data that comes to us over time. Think of inflation rates coming to us, each with a date on them, GDP growth, financial market prices. Those are all time series data. They require the distinctive techniques that Clive and Rob have developed over a quarter of a century to analyze them. Clive and Rob established a strong and enduring tradition at UCSD, which continues to this time. Paul mentioned, we take U.S. News and World Report rankings very seriously when they agree with us. And this time, they've said UCSD is second in the nation in econometrics, second only to MIT. So, and that's very much because of Clive and Rob and the tradition they've established. Clive and Rob have agreed to present short versions of their Nobel Prize lectures. The lectures originally presented in Stockholm in 2003. We'll have time for questions and answers at the end of their talks. For those of you who want the full-length version and all the local color that goes with it, let me recommend going to the UCSD Economics website. That's www.econ.ucsd.edu. There's a hot link there to the Nobel Prizes. And once you get there, there are hot links to streaming video of the full-length Nobel talks, handsome pictures of recipients of the prize shaking hands with the King of Sweden, and at the link marked other, personal notes from the Engel family on how life changed as a result of the ceremonies. So it's a very colorful website, gives you the full story. Please join me now in welcoming Sir Clive Granger.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I've often been on the other side of this round table, but never on this side of the mic. I've been asked to talk on several different topics on this 20 minutes by different people. So Rob wants me to revise or reprise the Nobel talk, and other people have asked me to talk about the history of the department. So let me do the history of the department, first of all. And how the time series group got together and what we've achieved and how we did that. I came here in 1974, and Rob arrived a couple of years later. At that time, our group would not have been ranked in the top 20 in the country, maybe top 30 even. I mean, we probably weren't even considered as a group. 2 years later, after that, Hal White arrived and was a very important component. Then Jim Hamilton arrived a few years later, and that was the basis of the group. We picked time series analysis as an area to work in because we all felt this was an important area. And Ross already told you what a time series is. Let me give you a visual thought about a time series. And the one I used in the Nobel Prize lecture was a chain of pearls. You visualize a chain of pearls loosely linked. And so every pearl will be the next value of the time series. And they can't move apart too far apart. They're sort of closely together because of the links of the chain. And that's what the time series look like. It's a series of dots through time as you go along the pearl chain. And people like that. When I, after the talk in Stockholm, I asked people what they most liked about the talk. Also the chain of pearls. They like the chain of pearls idea. So the group we had here worked on time series analysis, and that time, this was not a common area to work on. Most econometrics groups were working on different topics. Time series analysis were not mentioned in econometrics textbooks very much. Occasionally they're mentioned in the last chapter, as sort of an afterthought, and dealt with very casually. Nowadays, textbooks in econometrics, some of them have nothing but time series in. They all have time series in as a very substantial part of the area. So time series as an area has grown up rapidly since 1974 when we got together. I think we're partly responsible for that. Why it's been so important, why it's gone up so well, is that when we started, there wasn't that much data available in pleasant form. But over the years, now data has become much more readily available. And the computers have got much, much faster and easier to use. So they together made working in time series much easier. What we did was try to provide techniques to analyze it. As a group, we got along very well. We met regularly. Every Tuesday, I think it was, we had lunch together and discussed research problems. It was a very easily flowing meeting. It wasn't a full meeting. We often went out together to lunch somewhere and just talked over problems. So we got together a lot. We socialized a lot. We worked together. Many of us worked together. We wrote papers together. We had very good visitors. We found it easy to get visitors to come to San Diego for some reason, particularly from the East Coast or from Europe. The weather in San Diego is famous around the world. So you say, we're in San Diego, well, lucky you in San Diego. And so we have very good visitors. And we got very good students. Initially a trickle of good students. And then our good students would get good jobs. And that would promote other good students to come. Eventually we got a lot of good students, I think. Enough good students, and they got then positions in very good universities, which promoted our department very well, and the whole thing fed back on itself. And so by collecting a good area to work in and to get and having a good organization around it, I think we devised a very nice area to be. Visitors enjoyed it. They told other people to come and so on. That was a very nice, pleasant aspect of it. So socially, it was very pleasant as well as academically. Whilst we were doing that, we found the way to get the Nobel Prize. And there's a clear formula for how to do it. I'll now tell you, it's not a secret. It has about five steps. First of all, you have to go to San Diego. Then you have to get a really good idea. And you wait 20 years. Then you retire from San Diego. And then you wait 2 or 3 months, and you get the Nobel Prize. And Rob and I both did that in this guarantee formula. Now, the difficulty is getting the good idea. And my idea was something called co-integration, which I'm not going to try and tell you about. It's quite technical. It says that a pair of series can both be smooth, but a combination of them, a difference between them, can be very unsmooth. And that doesn't always happen, often doesn't happen. But when it does happen, there's special other properties from that process, and it's based on something called the error correction model. That's what I'm not going to try and explain. But the implication of that is that you can get better forecasts over the previous models that were available. And so we found something that may occur in data, particularly in economic data. If it does occur, then you've got a way of getting better forecasts. And we developed that. Other people had other ideas. Each of us in the group had our own idea, essentially, a set of ideas. And all these ideas were not only interesting technically, but actually very, very relevant. All these ideas are now in the textbooks. I mean, they're have large areas in the textbooks now. And that shows that they were useful ideas. Now, when I got the Nobel Prize, the statement from the committee mentioned the word forecasting because of this thing. And so when I went around visiting places, people would assume that I could forecast everything. And so I would immediately be asked to forecast the stock market. And Rob will tell you probably why you can't do that, but that's something, I'm sure he gets more of this than I do, but that everyone thinks I can forecast the stock market, and I always tell them, if I could forecast the stock market, I wouldn't tell you anyway. I would just go and do it, and be, you know, living even better than I do live. As you travel around, you get put in situations which would never have occurred before getting the prize. I remember in Germany, I'd been there a few hours at a meeting of Nobel laureates and students. I asked if I could be interviewed on television. It was live television, I didn't realize that. And I was asked, the first question was on how to solve the German unemployment problem, which has been a problem there for many years. And what do I know about German unemployment? It's ridiculous. So you make some comment, hopefully not too stupid. And this sort of thing happens every time you go somewhere. You get a question which someone who's been in the country many years probably can't answer, but you as a Nobel Prize winner are supposed to have an answer for it. And I have other examples of that, which I won't go through. So lots of nice things happen. I've shaken hands with the Queen of England. I've shaken hands with the Prime Minister of China. I've shaken hands with the next mayor of San Diego, Donna Fry. And when I explained that to her, she said, well, I'm the only one who can give you a hug. And she did, so that's not very sort of human. So you get around and you meet interesting people, like interesting places. You're very well received always. People are very expect to enjoy what you're going to say, which is very nice. And that wasn't true before. And people have been very, very nice to me. Nottingham named a building after me, Nottingham University. Trinity College, Cambridge have made me an honorary fellow. And UCSD has given me my own parking place, which is the best of all. Paul Drake is responsible for that. And that's one of the things that I use every day, so that's great. Forecasting has been something that the department's always been involved with. It's something that is relevant for time series, but it's also very practical. So we can show that our research has always had a relevant aspect to it. So when we apply for NSF grants, we'd always say, well, it's going to be useful for forecasting, because the NSF could then say, well, that's good. And one time, Rob and I were actually amongst the world's experts in forecasting electricity demand. Very short-term electricity demand. If you wanted to forecast electricity demand tomorrow for, say, San Diego, hour by hour, we could do it very well, very, very accurately. It's an example of really good short-run forecasting. And we even won a competition against 6, 7, 8 other groups up in Northwest somewhere. To show how our methods of modeling could work in practice. And we tried to, we thought it would be interesting to write a paper about it, our experiences. We thought that people would like to know the technique we used in this forecasting. So we wrote this paper up, submitted to a good journal. It was rejected, and the reason was, the editor said that nobody would be interested in reading a paper which the winners were from San Diego, because they would expect it anyway. They would not be surprised that San Diego won a competition in forecasting. That wasn't the point of the paper. The point of the paper was, this is how we did it. But they couldn't get beyond the fact that Rob and I were in this winning competition. So our success, in a sense, made life difficult on occasions. We had to rephrase that whole paper, and it published eventually, but not in a very good place. Forecasting is now still a major part of the department. We are just writing a handbook of economic forecasting. Graham Elliott and Alan Timmerman and myself are the editors. And so that becomes still a major part of the progress here. So what do we do right? How do we make the department so successful? Or the econometrics section? In my opinion, we were a really good team. I think the quality of the group was small and also excellent in quality. That was fortunate. We didn't know that when we started. You just chose people who were pretty good and they turned out to be really good. That was just chance, maybe. We started off with a small group, became slightly bigger, eventually 6 people, now it's 5. Not me, because I'm retired, but there are now 5 people. We interacted a lot. Regularly in the department, we were mostly in, we mostly met each other, we would talk to each other in the corridor, we would interact with people all the time. We had weekly meetings. We were very inventive. We kept trying to think up new ideas, not merely pushing the boundaries that were there, but inventing new places to go to. And that was a deliberate attempt all the time to be inventive. I think that succeeded. Some of our new ideas just flopped totally. We don't remember those, but the other things that were successful are what we're famous for. The ideas proved to be relevant, as I said before. The students we attracted were very important to the department. The fact that we could manage to get very good students here, could support them, and the students themselves helped each other a lot. There was no competition within the students. A good student would raise the whole quality of the class. And that was a part of the aura of the group we had. We also associated with the rest of the department. We talked to other people in the department. We tried to interact with them, tried to ask if their problems could be, if we could be helpful to them and so forth. And we published with some other members of the department. And mostly, it was just enjoyable coming in every morning to the department. It was a nice place to be, interesting environment. It wasn't an area where you were competing with people all the time. I think that was the best aspect to me, was that I enjoyed my colleagues, I enjoyed my location, I enjoyed being in San Diego. And thank you for that.
Let me point out that Clive and Rob now hold 2 titles at UCSD. They are research professors and professors emeritus at UCSD. And now let us welcome research professor and professor emeritus Rob Engel.
I think actually we might have started the round table when I was chair. I can't remember exactly, but it was not as big a group as this. So it's great to see you all here today, and it's wonderful to be here, wonderful to be back. I thought I would, again, talk about a variety of different topics. I gave it the title of Good Ideas, and you'll see where that comes in, but let's just see where it goes. The Nobel Prize is actually given, I think, for good ideas. Hard work is important, but it's really not given for the hard work. It's given for the idea. The committee tends to look at a line of research which is promising, developing, or maybe already developed, and then they go back to the beginning to see what were the instrumental ideas that made it happen. And I think Clive has given a great description of how that happened and why that looks the way it does. about a year and a half ago, I was on sabbatical in Annecy, France, in a little apartment overlooking a canal and the Market Street, when the phone call from the Nobel Committee came in, and it was a most amazing moment. And the phone call concluded with the statement, "Your life will never be the same." And that's also been true for me. I didn't get to meet the Queen, but here's the King. So this is the collection of American Nobel Prize winners, some of which were born in America. This is where it actually happens. This is Stockholm. This is the Grand Hotel in Stockholm in a rare sunny moment. The place where the ceremony takes place is the after ceremony is in the Rathaus, which is this famous building. And this is the lecture that you were promised for today, and which you can find on the website. And I'm going to give you a piece of it, but I'm not going to give you all of it. So you can see me giving the lecture. Okay. The ceremony itself is a most spectacular ceremony. If you can see this, which is a little hard to see, the Swedish Royal Academy is across the back. The Stockholm Philharmonic is across the top. The Nobel laureates are here, and the Swedish royal family is on the right-hand side. I think if I do this, I'm going to mess up the film, right? Okay, so I will stop walking around. But in any case, here is a little bit of more of a close-up. So you can see Clive and myself on the front row there. And you also probably can see that we're on the end of the first row. It turns out that economics is always the last. It was the most recently created Nobel Prize. It was not in Alfred Nobel's will, but everything is done in an order where we are at the end of the list. This is the view that my son liked the best. This is the Swedish royal family, and you can see the queen in pink, but you especially notice her daughter, the crown princess, and that she has raised quite a few eyebrows, I think. After the ceremony, there's a dinner for 1,200 of your closest friends with gold place settings and must be several hundred waiters serving everybody simultaneously. And then there was the moment when Clive and I received the medal from the King of Sweden, and he said a couple of very quiet things to us each. We think they were Swedish, actually. It's a little hard to tell quite what it was, but and then we all practiced bowing, and this is my moment to bow, and the press captured it fairly without any humiliation, and this is my wife Marianne and Alfred Nobel and the medal all in one picture, so it's quite a nice memory. So as you've been told two or three times, you can see more in either the Nobel website or in my wife's blog, which has lots of pictures and so forth. So over the years, over the year and a half, I've been asked many times, what did I get this prize for? Especially I've been asked this by the press. And so the answer is I got it, was given the prize for the arch model. And what is the arch model? Well, it stands for autoregressive conditional heteroscedasticity. And I must say the press is not excited when I tell them that. In fact, people overall don't find that that's that informative. So the press will not stop there. I have to say something else. So they say, you know, this is a general purpose newspaper, can you tell me more what it is? So I'll say something like, it's an econometric model to measure and forecast risk. I say, okay, but really, how does it work? I mean, what kind of a model does that? I say, okay, well, you take a weighted average of past fluctuations of prices. So we're trying to measure the risk of a market like a stock market. So you want to know how much is it jumping around. So one way to do that is to take a look at how jumpy it's been in the past. And so this is a weighted average of the past. And they say, well, I don't know, that doesn't sound that that complicated. But really, can you say it any simpler? And I say, well, what it tells you is that when volatility is high, it's likely to stay high. And when volatility is low, it's likely to stay low, but maybe move back toward the mean. And this is the moment when the press says, and they gave you a prize for that? So in any case, it turns out to be a very powerful insight. And it is used in lots of places all the time. Every day, businesses, investment banks calculate the risk and the exposures they have in lots of different parts of their business, different parts of a portfolio, different locations around the world. Every day, trades are scheduled and executed based on volatility, and billions of dollars are traded in this way. Every day, derivatives traders follow volatility patterns in pricing and hedging their derivative books. And so I'm extremely fortunate to have stumbled onto a model, a very simple model, which has had so many important applications. Every academic would dream that his work could be find this useful place. And in fact, it's also been very, I think, instrumental in academic work, because it was really the first model which was designed explicitly for a financial context and has led to lots of developments of econometric methods in finance, which is now called financial econometrics. And so this is kind of, I think, where financial econometrics really started. So the model that I proposed is a very simple arch. And here we have a very simple arch. But that's not the end of the story. The next step was a generalized arch, which was introduced by Tim Boerslev, a PhD student at San Diego. And basically, he had a model which is now the one which is almost always used, which says that this weighted average can be thought of as a weighted average of the long-run average variance and what it was you thought the variance was going to be today when you made your forecast yesterday, and then the news, what happened yesterday. And this is the Garch model. And so here is an arch for Tim. This is at Duke, which is where Tim teaches. The second really major development is by Dan Nelson, who unfortunately passed away at a very early age at the University of Chicago. And this is the exponential Garch, or E-Garch model, which recognizes that up days in the stock market and down days in the stock market may be different, that they might have different effects on future volatility. And it turns out that this insight is very powerful, that when the stock market goes down, it has a bigger effect on future volatility than when it goes up, even though it might move the same direction, same amount. So these are two early contributions, but there are many others through looking at nonlinearities, long memory, complex dynamics. Much of this was done at UCSD by students, and much was done elsewhere. So here's an arch for Dan, and here is a list of some of the other arch models that have been proposed, and they go by wonderful names. There's the TARCH, STARCH, ARCH, NARCH, MARCH, SWARCH, SNP, ARCH, and so forth and so on. So here is a sort of a menu of a few other kinds of arches. Here's an old arch. Here is one that I see all the time now, although it doesn't actually have the Twin Towers behind it anymore. Here's a new arch, or a very old arch. The French version, Chateau d'Arche. So let me show you a little bit how it works. Here I have a little bit of history from the Standard & Poor's 500. And on the bottom in the red curve is the picture of the level of the Standard & Poor's stock index. It's a broad measure of the U.S. stock market. But really what we look at is typically the returns or the changes in it, and that's what's shown in the top. And when volatility changes, then what we see is that the amplitude of these changes goes up and down. And you can certainly see across the top there that some places the volatility, the movements are much bigger than in other places. And that's the actual phenomena that the ARCH model is designed to pick up, how this volatility is changing over time. And it's quite apparent in this picture. But there's one other thing that's apparent in this picture, which is that exactly when the volatility is high, like in a period here where you can see this amplitude is really big, you can look down here and notice that the market was really declining. So this was a bear market period. This actually happens to be 74. The bear market period corresponded to high volatility. And one of the things we now know is that volatility tends to be high when the market is declining. And this is a result of, or consistent with Nelson's observation that volatility models are asymmetric. Here, let's look at a little more recent period of history. We see in the 90s, there was an extraordinarily low volatility period in the middle 90s. This is when I first started consulting in New York, and the question was, are we in a new world, or is it going to go back up again? Well, it did go back up again, didn't it? We had high volatility in the late 90s as we had the internet bubble, or if you like, bubble. You can see the market rose and rose up till 2000, and volatility got higher and higher. And this corresponded to more and more risk that people were taking every day they held the market. And risk management does take account of that. It recognizes this higher volatility, but presumably the investment committee was convinced that the returns were high enough, the expected returns were high enough to merit the risks that were being taken in the internet. And many of us, of course, took these risks as well. When you look at what happened after 2000, of course, you see the market went down and volatility stayed high because we had a long, prolonged bear market and high volatility. We also had 9/11. But the striking thing I want you to see in this picture is what happens on the right-hand side from 2003 up to the present, and this is yesterday, is the last observation, we see very low volatility. And one of the striking events, financial events, that it's worth noticing is we're in a record low volatility period again, sort of like in the middle 90s. But there's a question of whether it's the same as the middle 90s or why do we have this kind of low volatility? If you estimate a Garch model on this sample period, you get a picture of volatility, which is shown in the blue curve on the bottom. And you see that it was low in the middle 90s. It rose up around 2000, and now it's had this dramatic decline at the end of the sample period. If we look a little more closely at it, you can see, looking to start from 2000 to 2005, you can see the level of the stock market on the top. And I've drawn two curves on the bottom. One is the Garch volatility forecast, and the other is something that you can actually look up in the newspaper, which is the volatility index, or VIX, which is derived from the options market. And you can see it tells pretty much the same story as what the Garch volatilities say. This is actually the link that I mentioned between derivatives markets and volatility models. They are all trying to figure out what's the future volatility going to be. And this is an estimate of what it looks like. And you see we've had this strong volatility decline just as the market is recovering. Volatilities are going down. The market is going up. Is it going to keep going up? What's it going to do? Everybody wants to know the answer to this question. And I think it's tied in with this low volatility period. So nobody really knows, but let me give you my my take on why volatility is so low. My view is that it's low in the short run, but not so low in the long run. That is, in the short run, there aren't a lot of things that are going to come along and upset this market. There are big risks, however, I think, in the long run. We're running big deficits. We have high energy prices. We have the declining dollar, which stimulates the U.S. economy. There are a lot of factors which are stimulating the economy, and yet the long-term interest rates have not yet risen. I expect they're going to rise. I think we're going to find rising long-term rates. I think the that is going to be a negative risk factor for the economy. And I think that the costs of this war are going to continue to go up, and we're going to feel like that's a real burden. And I think we may start paying more and more attention to the costs we're spending on anti-terrorism measures. And I think that those costs provide an awful lot of sand in the wheels of this economy. And when you start putting all these pieces together, you say the long-run outlook is not that great. So volatility is low in the short run, I think, because we don't think any of these effects are going to kick in right away. But I think in the long run, we expect the volatility is probably going to pick up again the way it has in the past, and these are some of the effects ways that it might happen. The flip side of low volatility, of course, is when there's low risk, there's actually also low return. So you can invest in the market, but you don't expect very high returns. And I think that is exactly what people feel, that there's no real big upside in the market today. And for all these same sort of reasons, there's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines waiting for some place to go. And I think that's why we're just sort of in a waiting game to see what's going to happen. So we have low volatility, but I don't expect that it's going to be low forever. Suppose we were to do this same experiment on January 1st, 2000. So here's what we would have seen. The prices went up dramatically. This is the same S&P, but at this point, we had high volatility. We could calculate what we thought the confidence bands might look like for future values of the stock price. So if you calculate these things using a Gartsch model and you forecast out over the next 4.5 years, whatever, till today, you get bands that look sort of like this. These are roughly 95% confidence bands. And what you see is that if the good band is the one that we see, the market was going to continue to go up more or less at the same rate. If the bad one is what you see, you can see there's a big decline is going to happen. Where we're going to go in that confidence band tells you a lot about what actually happened, events that were unforeseen at 2000 but did come to pass. I mean, 9/11 being one of the most obvious unforeseen events, but lots of other unforeseen events occurred at this period. So where did we go? Well, you know where we went. We went down, although we didn't actually break through this confidence band. And in fact, if you look at the market, it's been pretty much horizontal for the last 4 or 5 years. Well, if you were to do this today, you'd probably find these bands were closer in. So there isn't that much upside, and there isn't that much downside. Just kind of a boring thing to look at, right? Now, as soon as I say that, of course, the market's probably going to fall out of bed, but I'm just giving you my view as to how all these things look. So let me come back to the title of the talk that I proposed, which is Good Ideas. Where do good ideas come from? I think the Nobel ideas are very good ideas, but they're really just good ideas that were lucky. They happened to fall on fertile ground, big plants grew, and things were effective. Where do our good ideas come from? Well, mine came from working on a macroeconomics problem, which was proposed by Milton Friedman who said that he thought business cycles were a result of uncertainty in inflation. So inflation was the big issue of the time. And Clive had recently shown me a test for bilinear models, which turned out to have lots of evidence there were bilinear models every place. Although you might wonder whether that's really what the implication was. And then, of course, all this time series work that we had been doing together in San Diego. If you put these three ideas together, I came up with an arch model, and this was in 1979, and it was published in 82. So, you know, it's quite a while ago. Then Tim invented the Garch model. David Lillian and Russ Robbins got me interested in financial applications, and we talked about the arch and mean model. Jeff Woolrich and I applied this to asset allocation. Mustafa Chowdhury, Ted Hong, Victor Ng applied this to options, and the possibilities in finance seemed very wide open. This was a research program in San Diego, which was, I think, very successful. We attracted a lot of interest. I spoke in a variety of financial groups. I started some consulting. I started working in market microstructure. And two decades flew past, two decades of extraordinary productivity, I think. I decided to go to NYU, but I haven't left San Diego. I've merely added, I think. I am still an emeritus professor and a research professor here. I have my office, and I spend my summers here. I have students here as well as students at New York University. I went to NYU because I wanted to be in the middle of the financial markets. And I teach MBAs and PhD students. And the students that I teach, some of them have just gotten off the options desk an hour beforehand, and they come and tell me what they saw. And I tell them some theory, and it's very stimulating experience. I always like simple models. In fact, Einstein's quote, "as simple as possible but no simpler," seems like it's a pretty nice way to think about what good ideas ought to look like. I like to look at one problem from the point of view of another. I think that's the way the Arch model came about. A good idea has legs. It illuminates in new settings. A good idea today may appear trivial tomorrow. And actually, that's probably a good thing, because it means it was so good that once you see it, it's almost obvious. I mean, I think you may not feel this way, but I think both arch and co-integration are examples of ideas. Once you really see them, they're almost obvious. Good ideas often pop into mind at conferences or odd times or when having a conversation with economists or even in class or breakfast. Good ideas come from a relaxed mind. They often come from attempts to prove something else. Universities are incubators for good ideas. Students bring us good ideas, often laden with irrelevancies. So we help them sort through them to see the best. We offer them our own ideas. We often can see better where the ideas will go than the students do. They write papers, dissertations, and get jobs based on these ideas. Faculty use good ideas to write research papers. We give lecture tours. We attract good students. We attract collaboration with our peers. And research groups are formed, like the lunch groups that Clive was talking about, for informal setting for discussing good ideas. And then universities are great beneficiaries of good ideas. When there are lots of good ideas at the university, universities will be successful in raising funds from granting agencies. They'll be successful in drawing in the community and growing the whole enterprise. They're successful in attracting the best students. They're successful in attracting the best faculty, and more good ideas will come. Here are three quotes, which I think kind of summarize a lot of this. "The universe is full of magical things, patiently waiting for our wits to grow sharper." It's not all been done. To see what is in front of one's nose requires a constant struggle. And to select well among old things is almost equal to inventing new ones. A lot of wisdom in those three quotes. So I'm pleased that so many of you could come today. We count on you to help us become good incubators and hope you go home with some good ideas. Thank you.